Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave.
And I'm Liz.
And this is episode 94 on the Joggins Fossil Cliffs. So Liz, why this location as the focus for this interview?
Joggins is one of the sort of five UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Canada based on fossils. And it's a really kind of interesting and important place that I really didn't know a lot about before this. So I guess through Twitter, I have talked to Melissa, the curator that I interviewed in this recording, and kind of got to know her through Twitter and thought this was sort of a great excuse to find out more about Joggins and tell lots of people about it.
I have to admit that I haven't been overly familiar with the Joggins fossils. Like I'd heard about it from going to conferences and things like that, but being an invertebrate person, I didn't really think that there was much there for me.
Yeah, that's actually something really interesting about Joggins, is that it's got everything. I mean, you might say as an invertebrate paleo that you didn't really know about it because there wasn't much there, but it's actually got everything from invertebrates all the way up to vertebrates, to botany, to trackways. It has, you know, the whole kind of ecosystem there, which makes it really, really interesting. And yet people don't really realize it.
Well, speaking of important Canadian sites, I am now back from the Arctic.
Oh yeah, how did that go?
It was amazing. I'm not going to lie, it was pretty cool. Literally and figuratively. Yeah, we found so many things. It was unbelievable. And we're going to be releasing the multimedia from that expedition pretty soon. But just as a sneak preview, I mean, wow, we found some amazing stuff. Like, there were ups when we found all of these, like, insane fossils. But, like, most of the trip was not that great. It was only on the last few days that we just exploded with fossil discoveries, and it was something else. It's going to be a pretty good episode, and when you see all the videos that we've taken and see what the environment was like and all of that stuff, it was so much fun.
That sounds amazing. I mean, I can't wait to hear about it, let alone everybody else. I haven't heard or seen anything about it, so I can't wait to see.
Yeah, and we've had quite a lot of episodes with a Canadian focus, and maybe it's for that reason that we have actually been nominated for the People's Choice Award, Canada's Favourite Science Blog. And so that is something that's come out of Science Borealis. Liz, can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, so Science Borealis is a Canadian sort of science blogging community. I guess I should say as a disclaimer, I do actually volunteer for Science Borealis, so I was completely not involved in the kind of blog award part. And we kind of aggregate Canadian science blogs and get them out there so that more people will read the blogs and they can go and see what's going on in Canadian science. And it's, I mean, partially with that, and also because, I mean, obviously I am Canadian, that we've managed to get a lot of Canadian related episodes, and apparently people like them, which is great.
Good. And so if you do like them and you like PaleoCast in general, you're able to vote for PaleoCast. You can nominate three blogs and sites, which is six votes in total. And that's going from today until the 29th of September. So it's just a window of less than 2 weeks. And we will share a link to where you vote, both on social media, and we'll also have a banner on our website that you can click. So if you do like the Canadian stuff that we produce, then please, please vote for us in this competition.
And anyone can vote. So if you can make sure you register and get your vote in before the end of September, that would be great.
And in addition, we'd like to know what your favourite Canadian episode of Paleocast has been so far. We've had quite a few, so there's Isatelus Rex, Mistaken Point, Medusae, Anomala Caryatids, Dinosaurs of Alberta, Understanding Biodiversity, the Burgess Shale, Rangiomorph Reproduction, Ankylosaurs, Blue Beach Tetrapods, the Golden Age of Dinosaur Discovery, Teeth and Herbivory in Reptiles, Ichthyornis, Squamate Origins, and the Expedition. And finally, this one about the Juggins Fossil Cliffs with Dr. Melissa Gray.
You just had to put an aboot in there, didn't you?
I did.
Thanks for joining me today, Melissa. Why don't we go ahead by starting off with you introducing yourself and kind of telling us how you got to where you are now at Joggins.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Liz. It's a real pleasure to be here. I've been curator at Joggins for 9 years now, been here since 2009. That's just 1 year after the designation of the site as a UNESCO World Heritage Site and the center being built. So that all happened in 2008. Before that, I was in Vancouver at UBC finishing up my PhD. I've come from a background of biology, and I've always been really interested, particularly in evolution, and paleontology provides a great way to study that. Moving into the Carboniferous realm was a bit different for me. I was typically studying animals from the Mesozoic, and so that was a different, a bit of a move for me, but really enjoying it so far.
Cool. So I guess the first kind of question is, where are the Joggins Fossil Cliffs?
Yeah, they're in a little known part of Nova Scotia, Canada, along the Cumberland Basin, which is an arm of the very famous Bay of Fundy with the highest tides in the world.
So what are the kind of significance of the fossils, and what is the age that you get of the fossils in Joggins?
All of the fossils here are from the late Carboniferous, and the World Heritage Site spans about 15 million years, from about 310 to 325 million years ago. So they're all sedimentary rocks from, as I said, the late Carboniferous or Pennsylvanian period. Mm-hmm. And the site's really significant for, well, a number of reasons. One reason why most people have heard of us is because of the standing trees, the trees that are in situ within the cliffs. And something a little bit less well-known, but well-known within the scientific community, is that we have evidence of the earliest known reptile in the fossil record that was found from here. And actually, that very first reptile, Hylonomus, that was found here in the 1850s is on display in the British Museum in London.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. We had it on display in 2010. It took me about almost a year to secure that loan because it is such an important specimen. So we had it on display briefly. And we did ask if we could keep it, but
so they must. That must have been found a long time ago then, if it's in the British Museum.
That's right. So, you know, obviously in the 1850s when it was found, there was no museum here at Joggins, and that was a natural home for it. And it's been, you know, residing there for over 150 years. So it makes sense that it should stay there, but it was really special to have it here.
Yeah.
At least for one season.
Yeah. So how old is the museum at Joggins?
The museum's been here since 2008. So we actually just celebrated our 10th year anniversary as a museum, but UNESCO World Heritage Site as well.
Yeah.
Before the museum was built, there was a little community run museum up the road, which we all lovingly call the Log Cabin. And that's where a local gentleman who used to be a miner here and collected fossils all his life and just had a real passion for the place. His name was Don Reed. And so he ran that little museum and even tours of the beach before this museum opened. And interestingly, when this museum opened, he donated his entire collection of Joggins fossils to us. Yeah. So his collection comprises almost about 60% of our current collection.
Wow. That's very impressive.
It is, yes. He amassed a huge amount of material.
Yeah. Is there still a lot of kind of active field work happening there?
Definitely, yeah. So I have my own research program, but we still have visitors and researchers from all over the world who come to do research here. And we started a research associate program. We have a science advisory committee. So we are pretty in tune with trying to keep research on the go at the site.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned before that it's on the Bay of Fundy, which of course has, as you said, the massive tides. So how does that affect the sort of, you know, field work, finding the fossils?
Yeah, it affects things drastically, actually. I tell people, and this is true, every single time I go to the beach, and I'm lucky enough to have my office literally perched over my field site, so it's literally about a 2-minute walk to the beach. Every time I go down, it's different because the tides are shuffling things around, and it's quite amazing the amount of rock that they can move. You know, you could get massive rock weighing hundreds and hundreds of pounds that can be completely flipped over throughout a tidal cycle. There's also a bit of a longshore drift, so fossils tend to move down the beach as they fall out of the cliffs. And the cliffs are constantly eroding, not so much because of the tidal action, but that just the tidal action definitely unearths quite a lot. And so, yeah, you never know what you're going to find when you go down there. Different every time.
Yeah. Are most of the fossils found sort of on the, you know, on the beach, like where you're walking, or are they in the cliffs or combination?
It's a combination. And I mean, that's one thing that's really special about the site is that we have our, you know, a lot of the fossils are still in situ. So they're still within the cliff face, or at least within the rock face. But they do, you know, they do fall out, and they're, you can literally not help but to step on them when on the beach because they're everywhere. So yeah, you know, obviously they're a bit out of context when they're loose on the beach. And so if we're doing something like studying evolution, for instance, and we want to get things that came directly from the cliffs, or the reef, the rocky reefs. So, yeah, but most of our collection, to be honest, has come sort of loose ex situ. Yeah.
And you already mentioned the, I can't remember how you worded it, but sort of the tree stumps and the sort of swamp forests. Can you go into that in a little bit more detail and talk about sort of the significance of those trees?
Sure, yeah. So, you know, over 300 million years ago, the continents formed a large continent known as Pangaea, and Joggins was actually almost in the center of that large continent, and in the middle of a very large or vast rainforest type environment, and with lots of swampy areas. The trees growing at the time were primarily lycopods, so these club mosses that could get to be really huge, you know, 9 meters or so tall. And it turns out that we at Joggins can find these trees preserved within the cliffs in situ as if they're still growing. They look almost like Roman pillars. And so they're quite a sight to be viewed, and definitely always highlights of our tours. We keep a close eye on the trees because there's fossils that are also found within those fossils. And in fact, that's where the earliest known reptile Hylonomus was originally found. Was within, preserved within one of these trees. But we also find other things like land snails and millipedes and whatnot.
with the trees, how much of them are preserved? You said that they're kind of in situ and you get sort of a stump, but do you get actual 9-meter trees, or is it kind of half a tree, or?
Yeah, they're actually in sections. So what probably happened and how the trees were preserved, they're essentially casts.
Okay.
So they're either completely sandstone or mudstone. And there's no original, cellular material preserved. It's just the sandstone or mudstone. And probably what was happening was the trees would naturally die out through cycles of flooding events, for instance. And you might imagine that when a tree like that, a club moss, dies, that sort of spongy interior would probably rot much more quickly than the outer bark and then get infilled with successive flooding events, bringing in that sand or mud. And so that's how they're preserved, and that's probably why they're preserved in these smaller sections, because it could record successive flooding events.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, we don't find 9-meter trees, but we can find, some of them are just small, less than a meter, and some of them can reach up to a few meters. Yeah, and it's sort of luck of the draw what you find when you go down. As I mentioned, the cliffs are constantly eroding, so sometimes trees last in the cliffs for years and sometimes only a season.
And you mentioned that you often find fossils within the trees. So how big are they sort of in diameter? What kind of things are you finding inside other than this reptile you mentioned?
Right. So the diameter of the trees can range, but mm-hmm. basically from about 30 centimeters to maybe 60 or so.
Okay.
They can be quite wide,
mm-hmm.
Less than a meter wide generally. But we find things that were probably living inside these rotting out tree trunks, like millipedes, detritivores. And we also find land snails occasionally in them. So we like to keep our eyes out on the trees just to see. You never know if we'll find another hyalonimus.
So we have plants, or at least we have the trees you've mentioned so far, and things like millipedes and detritivores, and then this reptile. So how much of the entire ecosystem is preserved, or at least can you guess?
Excellent question. I think something special about Joggins is that, not only are things preserved in situ, but we have the entire food web preserved here. So it's not just the primary producers or the plants, but we have, the whole food web right up to the top predators, which at the time was probably a large amphibian, which we lovingly call Rex. Not T-Rex, though. we have detritivores and flying insects, as I mentioned, reptiles, amphibians, and it's not only the terrestrial realm. So while we're quite famous for, the forest swamp-like environment, we actually also have the aquatic realm preserved. And so that's what I've been studying mostly, are the limestones at Joggins.
Okay.
That are very fossil rich.
Yeah. So what kind of things come out of the limestones?
Mainly ostracods, bivalves, and lots of different fish parts. So anything from scales to teeth to jaws, and other body parts. And of course, coprolites, which is something that I've been delving into in more detail and studying 300 million year old fish poo.
What? So how can you, I know very little about coprolites, and especially, marine type coprolites. What kind of information can you get? And is it easy to say what animal it came from or anything about it?
Well, this is what we are trying to discover. And it seems like, I'm in the process writing a paper with my honor student on this, but we're finding different morphotypes of coprolites and associating that with different levels of the trophic pyramid. We know there are lots of different types of fish that lived at the time based on their body parts. So we're actually now just getting at some of those trophic interactions or those species interactions by seeing which fish were eating what. Because it turns out when you slice open the coprolites and look at them under microscopes, you can actually see bones and teeth and scales of other fish in there.
Interesting.
So it's quite an interesting focus of study.
I wasn't familiar at all with the existence of kind of limestone proper marine stuff at Joggins. So I guess, how does that work if you have the swampy terrestrial part and then also the limestoney marine part? Is that over a different period of time, or is it one kind of gradually moving into the other? I'm trying to picture this in my mind and how that works.
Well, so I'll actually probably allay some of your concerns about that, because the limestones, it turns out, are probably more brackish to freshwater.
Okay.
We don't have any evidence of marine-only organisms preserved here. So yeah, but we do get cycles of the limestones coming in throughout, for instance, the Joggins Formation, which is the most heavily studied part of the UNESCO World Heritage Site. So there are about 14 different limestones throughout the formation. And I was studying the ostracods and looking at how they may have changed as a result of environmental changes over time. We are finding that there was a bit of a marine influence at the base of the section, so earlier on, and then as we move up through the section, the water was getting fresher or brackish.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, definitely didn't know that at all.
It is a little known fact that we have marines, or that we have limestones here.
Yeah. Going back to plants, what other plants are there than just the trees? Do you get other plant fossils as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly the plants take up the majority of our collection as well. And that's definitely something that I guarantee anyone can find when they go on the beach, because there's just literally so much plant material at the time. So we have the club mosses and two different types of those. We have the lepidodendron and the sigillaria. But then we also have early conifers, which are chordates. And we see those in a different part of the section. We can talk about that a bit later. But we also have calamites, which are early horsetail relatives. And of course, horsetails today generally get up to about the size of the height of your knee. These things could grow again about 9 meters tall. So they were huge. Yeah. And then of course, some of my favorites are the ferns, the seed ferns. I really love those because, again, when you find one on the beach, you do not have to be a paleontologist to identify that it's a fern. It's really obvious.
Yeah.
Really beautiful. Yeah.
What do these different types of plants tell us about the environment at this time?
Yeah, so we have a number of different environments preserved at Joggins, and of course the fossils help us delineate those. The most common environment is the poorly drained or wetland type environment, where we have the sort of the swampy forests, and that's where you see the lycopods and the tree ferns primarily, and the calamites. But it's the chordates that really delineate the upland or dryland environment, and so those are seen in different parts of the section, and so we really have this nice delineation between the wetlands and the drylands here.
Ah, it's interesting. It's nice to see kind of the whole change of the different environments and actually be able to put fossils with that.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then do you have kind of associated animal fossils that you typically find with the different environments as well?
Yeah, good question. I mean, with the uplands, I mean, we do find trackways, and I'm sure we'll discuss those quite a bit because Joggins is quite famous for its record of tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do find trackways, probably mostly of reptiles, maybe some amphibians straying away from the swampy forests. Certainly there's more biodiversity in the wetlands than the drylands. So we're not seeing nearly as many different types of fossils in the dryland environment.
Okay. Going into kind of animals and talking a little bit more about the different diversity that we see, we can start with kind of invertebrate type things, since that's more of your background. Can you tell us a little bit about, I mean, we've kind of touched on it already, but a little bit more about the different groups of invertebrates that are found there and their significance?
Yeah, sure. I always like to talk about Arthropleura, which mm-hmm. is the largest known land invertebrate of all time.
Wow.
And yeah.
It's a good title.
it's significant. And but interestingly, at Joggins, we only have found thus far their trackways, and there's many, many, many of them. But we have not yet, or as far as we know anyway, have not yet found body fossils. So that's definitely on my bucket list of things to find at Joggins. But we do certainly, they were certainly here. And, you know, quite a wide range of size, from probably quite juvenile to adult sizes. And adults could get to over a meter long. So these things were indeed large detritivores crawling through these sort of swampy forests.
And what kind of animal is Arthropleura? Is it a millipede type thing, if I remember correctly?
That's right. It's really, related to a millipede. So when I talk about them to visitors, I say, imagine, you know, a meter long millipede crawling towards you on the forest floor. And some people kind of shriek in horror. Extinct now, don't worry.
Yeah.
And they're detritivores anyway, so they're not interested in you necessarily, but they're really fun. I love the Arthropleura. But then beyond that, of course, we also have the earliest known land snail preserved here. We don't have many of those in our collection, but they are, you know, they're about a centimeter long, these little land snails, Dendropipa. And then more flying insects, things like Meganeura, these sort of mayfly, dragonfly relatives that in other places globally could reach, you know, half a meter wingspan or up to a meter wingspan. Here we have some fossilized specimens in our collection. They're a bit smaller, but nevertheless, they're here. Mm-hmm. What else? We also, one of the most unique specimens in our collection on the animal side of things is a scorpion. And we literally only have one specimen of that. But again, looking for more, but they were clearly around. And things like whip spiders as well. We have some abdomens preserved. So yeah, quite a range of biodiversity of those sort of terrestrial invertebrates.
Yeah. You mentioned, of course, the Arthropleura trackways. Are there other trackways as well?
There very much are. Joggins is quite famous, I think, among ichnologists because of the plethora of trackways that are preserved here, including, you know, from both amphibians and reptiles, presumably. The largest trackway that we have from a vertebrate is Rex. Presumably he's an amphibian. He or she is an amphibian. Mm-hmm. And those trackways get to be about the size of an adult's hand.
Okay.
So they are quite large. And again, though, we only see their trackways here. We have not found any, at least definitive evidence of bones from Rex yet.
And things like Arthropleura that you have definite trackways from, are there body fossils known from other sites?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So that's how we know that there are Arthropleura trackways and not something else, because they match so closely with, I think there's a trackway in Scotland where they actually had the body fossil preserved at the end of the trackway. So that's always handy.
Yeah, that's very helpful.
Yes.
And then I guess with the amphibian trackways, it might be a little bit more difficult to necessarily associate with a body somewhere else.
That's the challenge with ichnology in general, I
guess.
Yeah.
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 Do you have a sort of estimate of, okay, this is a kind of mean question, I guess, but sort of an estimate of how many different species of sort of invertebrates are known from Joggins?
For invertebrates?
Yeah.
And we're not talking trackways, just no. Like from body or in general?
I guess in general.
Yeah. I would say about probably 20 or so different species. Overall, we have about 200 species of plants, animals preserved here. So I would say, maybe 10% of those are, at least that we see in our collection and that we see, commonly, it's about 10% of those are invertebrates.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. And then going into sort of the vertebrate side of things, other than Rex, of course, you mentioned Hylonomus already. Can you talk a little bit more about why it's so important and sort of the significance and what it is?
So, Hylonomus lyelli, which the original specimen found from here in the 1850s, still remains to be the most complete specimen, though there are others that have been found from here since and are in other museums as well. But this is the Hylonomus is the oldest known reptile in the fossil record. And so it represents this really important branch of the evolutionary tree for tetrapods, wherein they were able to leave the water entirely and not have to go back to reproduce like amphibians had to do. So, and really that all came about because of this interesting evolutionary innovation of the amniotic egg, and that these reptiles were able to produce, which allowed them to stay on land. So, Hylonomus is also Nova Scotia's provincial fossil, interestingly, because of its significance. And as I said, it was originally found here in the 1850s. That original specimen was found inside fossilized trees. They're not exclusively found within trees, but we are always on the lookout for that because we tend to get more of a complete skeleton that way. But I like to talk about that original specimen a little bit, especially with the public, because it's something that you could so easily bypass if you were to see it again on the beach. These reptiles were small, probably only about 20 centimeters long in total. So each individual bone is pretty tiny, though visible. But it's not that specimen that's so important is not your sort of typical, beautifully articulated, large vertebrate skeleton. It's actually a smattering of small bones. And so I think it's really a nice specimen to show that, not every scientifically critical fossil is what you imagine it to be.
Yeah, definitely.
And, something that could be easily potentially overlooked. And in fact, I think it was always viewed as significant even from when it was first discovered, but it wasn't until about 100 years later when it was determined that it was indeed a reptile. And so far, at least, still holds the record for the earliest reptile in the fossil record.
That's really cool, especially that it's been known for so long and still manages to be the oldest. So,
yeah. in paleontology, we like to find the oldest or the biggest or the smallest.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Kind of going back to Joggins as a whole, sort of generally, how is it so different from other sites of similar age? What makes it kind of as important as it is?
Certainly there are other late Carboniferous sites globally and other sites with really beautiful preservation, but Joggins has this really kind of almost perfect combination of excellent preservation that's in situ And with about 15 million years of uninterrupted geologic time preserved. So that sort of magic three puts it really high on the list of Carboniferous sites in the world.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And then kind of sort of wrapping up, talking about general sort of current Joggins research, you're actually holding a symposium to celebrate the 10-year anniversary. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and some of the new research that might be talked about or how that kind of is going to go and more about that?
For sure, yeah. So on September 22nd, next month, we're holding the Joggins Research Symposium, very first one, hopefully to be more, to highlight the sort of recent and current research that's happening here and in the late Carboniferous in general, what some of the important questions are. So yeah, that's in celebration of our 10th anniversary, and we're hoping to get people from all over North America and even the world to send in, because we'll be doing we'll have poster sessions and little talks as well. So hoping to get a good turnout of people here. And yeah, we'll be talking, you know, a lot about the current work that's going on at the site. For instance, there's a group from Carleton, Dr. Hillary Madden and her students come here every year looking for new tetrapods, essentially. She's looking at tetrapod evolution in the late Carboniferous, and Nova Scotia, and particularly Joggins, is on her list of places to visit every year. So she'll be talking about some of the newest research in that area and what they've been finding. I will be discussing some of my work with my colleagues on fish coprolites and slicing them open and looking at them under SEM and whatnot. Certainly we'll have a group from St. Mary's University talking about ichnology. They're doing a lot of work on these Rex trackways and otherwise as well. So, you know, and of course from trackways, we can get a little bit more about behavior of the animals. So yeah, hoping to hear more of the current stuff on that. It'll be quite a wide variety. We'll have a sedimentologist here talking about some of the earliest log jams in the fossil record, which we see at Joggins. And probably we'll talk a little bit about extinction, because, you know, at the end of the Carboniferous, these really large, this global rainforest starts to collapse as the climate changes and tectonic activity. And so I think that will be part of the discussion as well, talking about the timing of that and the recovery after some of these extinction events. So I think there'll be quite a broad range of topics covered.
That's great. It's great to know that there's, you know, a lot of current and very diverse research still going on at Joggins and lots of different groups. So it's really interesting. I look forward to hearing about what comes out.
And the exciting thing too is that, you know, obviously our field trip is going to be at Joggins. So we're we're right here, we're steps away. And the interesting thing about that is we're planning a group led field trip. So everyone who gives a talk or a paper will partake in leading the field trip. So it should be fun. But it is open to the public as well. So it's not just for researchers. It's open to anyone who's interested. So be interested to see how many people come out and around the local community.
Yeah. And if anybody is listening to this who's around Nova Scotia, definitely go check it out if you haven't already.
September 22nd.
Well, I think that's great. Thank you very much, Melissa. I really enjoyed that.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Liz.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed @PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.